pointed out sugar's profound negative effect on early armies, and even entire nations, as it was introduced to them one by one. His research makes a strong and logical case that the incidence of diabetes and other diseases grew significantly as refined sugar consumption increased. Why have the early physicians and anti-sugar crusaders' insights and observations never caught on? The refined sugar lobby has been very powerful for a couple of centuries. The economic stakes in the sugar trade between nations were extremely high. Slavery even flourished because of it. Pro-sugar lobbying by sugar growers, soft drink manufacturers, and the packaged food industry has been very effective in influencing our government. What politician wants to tell his or her constituents that they should no longer eat sugar? Is it wrong to lobby for one's own product? No, but it is wrong to minimize the very serious side effects of too much refined sugar consumption, such as causing a higher incidence of diabetes, a very serious disease with severe consequences for many of our organs. The main problem with society's ignorance of sugar's evil effects probably lies in our tendency to ignore what we do not want to hear. Information about the health problems sugar can cause has been out there, but people simply did not want to hear the message. Like alcoholics hooked on alcohol, our society is hooked on sugar. People say, "Just don't tell me that sugar is bad, too." Yet, when we initially self-published our book, it took only a little over 2 years to see more than 200,000 copies sold and for it to build up a legion of successful followers. As the book was not advertised, the buzz must have come by word of mouth. Following the success of that early book, and prior to the sale of this current book, the professionally published hardcover version of Sugar Busters, Cut Sugar to Trim Fat, leapt to the number one spot on the New York Times bestseller list, remained there for months, and sold well in excess of 2 million copies. People simply needed a simple, straightforward explanation of how consumption of sugar and other high glycemic index carbohydrates was really going to make them fat and unhealthy. There is some interesting information on average lifespan that might surprise you. The statistic that men's life expectancy has increased by 50% in the last century is accurate, but is misleading in that it is nearly all due to a tremendous decrease in infant and early childhood mortality. Middle-aged American men only live a couple of years longer on average than they did in 1900, despite the availability of flu shots, penicillin for pneumonia, antibiotics, early detection technology, transplant capability, and multiple life support systems, all of which, admittedly, can make a difference in individual cases. But we are concerned with population-wide statistics here. We also have refrigeration and improved packaging technology, which allow us to eat a wide variety of food all year. And you cannot go into any food store or drugstore without finding shelves and shelves of vitamins, minerals, and other supplements. Why doesn't all this preventive medicine, year-round availability of a balanced diet, and life support technology result in more than a 2-year extension of an average middle-aged man's life? We believe the main culprit is the major change to refined foods, including refined sugar. This has done to our entire population exactly what it did to royalty over the last few centuries. The privileged could afford white bread and lots of sugar, which rapidly took a toll by making them fat and giving them gout and diabetes. Just because we have everything in the world to eat doesn't mean we really eat better, or even as well as most of our forefathers who ate in the fashion for which their digestive systems were designed. In fact, we believe that a middle-aged man's general quality of life, despite the medical wonders, has diminished. The miraculous medical advances have been offset by the tremendous rise in sugar intake, as shown in Figure 4 on your PDF companion, and the consumption of other high-glycemic, low-fiber foods. When you see the increase in disease caused by our huge consumption of refined sugar and certain other carbohydrates, it is quite logical to add refined sugar to the priority list of things that are or may be hazardous to your health. Too much sugar just may be the number one culprit in lowering quality of life and causing premature death. There certainly is enough evidence to bring us to that conclusion. If the sugar causes disease message has not caught on yet, why do we think another book about it is worth the effort? Excess insulin is causing problems that can kill people prematurely, and even those who survive to an older age often have a greatly reduced quality of life. The importance of insulin was ignored in the vast majority of nutritional and dietetic literature until just very recently. The insulin connection needs to be better understood and must be told over and over until it is appreciated. You can benefit from a low-sugar diet. One of the good old clichés is very applicable here. Today is the first day of the rest of your life. Think about it. Finally, the basic principles outlined in Sugar Busters have been field-tested by the human digestive system throughout the eons. The Sugar Busters lifestyle is unlike recent diet and supplement programs that are long on promise but short on proof. These new claims are all too often proven to be false or ineffective after a few years of research. Worse yet, some of these diet plans and pills turn out to be dangerous to our health. But every time a new gimmick gets widely publicized, someone makes a ton of money from the sales attached to it. In contrast, following the principles of the Sugar Busters lifestyle costs essentially nothing. Chapter 4. Calculating Fatness and Obesity. How do you know whether you or your children are of normal body weight or are fat or obese? You cannot always tell simply by your appearance or your children's or by comparison with others, because the weights of adults and children have increased dramatically over the past few decades, and as populations become heavier, the perception of what is normal weight changes. The Body Mass Index, BMI, is a standardized tool to determine the amount of body fat both in adults and children. The Body Mass Index is a calculation of a person's weight relative to height. The BMI can be calculated by dividing weight in pounds by height in inches, dividing that result by height in inches again, and finally multiplying that result by 703. For example, if your weight is 140 pounds and your height is 5 feet, 60 inches, the calculation would be as follows. 140 divided by 60 equals 2.33. Then 2.33 divided by 60 equals 0.0388. And 0.0388 times 703 equals 27.2764. Rounding down, that produces a BMI of 27. In adults, since height is fixed, the BMI changes only with weight. A BMI equal to or greater than 25 in adults indicates overweight. A BMI equal to or greater than 30 indicates obesity. Those potential complications of overweight and obesity can be found in Chapter 6. For children, go ahead and calculate their BMI as you did for yourself. However, since the weights and heights of children change with age, The BMI changes until growth is complete. The Centers for Disease Control have gathered data on children relative to height, weight, and age to calculate their BMI percentiles. For male and female children aged 2 to 20, their intersection of their age and BMI can be found in figures 5 and 6 on your PDF companion. A child whose BMI versus age plots at or above the 85th percentile, that is, he or she weighs more than 85% of children of the same age, height, and sex, is considered to be overweight. Any child whose BMI is at or above the 95th percentile is considered to be obese, and this obesity is very likely to persist into adulthood. Approximately 25% of children in the United States are overweight or obese. Note that the BMI charts may not work for a small number of children. For instance, some athletic, muscular children may have a normal amount of body fat, yet have a high BMI, and children who are very inactive may have a normal BMI, but an unhealthy amount of body fat. In spite of these limitations, the BMI is considered to be extremely useful in identifying weight problems in most children. Consult your child's pediatrician if you have any concerns. You can also use the calculators at the Centers for Disease Control website to calculate your BMI. These are found on the Internet at www.cdc.gov/nccdphp/dnpa/bmil/calc-bmi.htm and www.cdc.gov/nccdphp/dnpa/bmi/bmi-4-age.htm. BMI can be a useful tool for determining whether you are at risk for the complications of overweight and obesity. The Sugar Busters way of eating will help you and your children achieve and maintain a normal, healthy weight. The medical literature is now full of studies that indicate the following health problems are more prevalent in significantly overweight and obese people. Type 1 diabetes, CV disease, strokes, high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, elevated triglycerides, asthma, sleep apnea, incontinence, eating disorders, indigestion, migraine headaches, polycystic ovaries, stress, certain cancers, low self-esteem, depression, suicide. Chapter 5. Prevention. For the majority of you, this is the most important chapter in the book. To be able to live and enjoy life to its fullest, you must remain in good health or regain your lost health. The Sugar Busters lifestyle is designed to provide you with the types of foods that are most naturally acceptable to your body. Foods that contain generous amounts of the vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients your body requires to function effectively. The best thing about this way of eating is that it delivers the desired results without the need for supplementation with expensive potions, pills, or assistance from personal trainers, unless you have already contracted some of the obesity-related diseases, such as cardiovascular disease or diabetes. Prevention of disease is our ultimate goal. While we would not be so brazen as to say that following the Sugar Busters lifestyle will prevent all the problems a body might develop, we are simply saying it is loaded with the good foods that have successfully nurtured our forebears through the eons when no medical help existed. To get started, let's talk about prevention of diabetes. Suppose a laboratory blood test could tell you that sometime in the future, your chance of developing type 2 diabetes is very high. There is no doubt that facing the prospect of having a heart attack, stroke, Loss of vision or amputation is very frightening. But there is hope to prevent this deadly disease. A blood test can help determine whether most people are already pre-diabetic. If anything you hear in this chapter or in chapter 13 makes you think you may have pre-diabetes or diabetes, go have your blood tested immediately. Recent scientific publications have revealed the causes and risk factors leading to the development of type 2 diabetes. A diet that is loaded with high glycemic carbohydrates can not only cause pancreatic exhaustion by repeated demands on the pancreas to release large amounts of insulin, but such a diet also promotes the condition of insulin resistance. Insulin resistance often precedes the development of type 2 diabetes. A person who has insulin resistance requires higher levels of insulin to maintain a normal blood sugar. The United States, in the late 20th and early 21st century, with its high glycemic Western diet, has become an ideal laboratory or culture medium for producing diabetics. Our baby boomers that have grown up on this diet are reaching the ages, late 50s and early 60s, when most persons are first diagnosed with diabetes. More than ever, our overweight children are reaching adulthood overweight and with a higher risk for the development of type 2 diabetes as compared to their parents. The population within many ethnic groups also is increasing rapidly, and many are at unusually high risk for developing the disease. Later in this chapter, we will give advice on how to prevent the development of type 2 diabetes. Well over 90% of the dollars spent by our government on health care are spent on treatment of illnesses. Little is spent on advising people how to not get sick in the first place. Other than our government's food pyramid, which was heavily influenced by lobbying from many powerful food manufacturers and which clearly did not work, or the don't eat fat or junk food approach, the general population has had to rely on what manufacturers and the pill and potion pushers have plied us with in copious amounts of advertising. Much of this advertising, whether in the media or printed on the packaging, has been subjected to minimal government scrutiny. Formal studies have not been done to prove or disprove most of the claims made by the peddlers of the information. We have all heard of the problems caused by inadequate long-term testing of many products that were championed as miracles, only to later be the subject of lawsuits because of the harm they caused. Why not keep yourself out of harm's way by simply eating a good variety of the more natural foods that the human body has functioned well on for centuries and centuries? The best way to obtain nutrients is through natural fruits, vegetables, meats, grains, nuts, dairy, and other foods instead of through pills or potions. Think of the new things now being found to be important to our health that were not recognized just a few short years ago, such as homocysteine, lysine, and lycopene. Most doctors, nutritionists, and scientists agree that we will continue to find other elements in our foods that may be playing important roles in our overall health. Two things are for certain. If a nutrient is not currently recognized, you will not find it in a pill. But if you are eating a good variety of healthful foods, your body will extract those nutrients to be used for your benefit, just as it has over the eons. If you do not exercise, and we strongly recommend that you do, you can at least get all of the benefits of eating a healthy diet. Do not say to yourself, "Well, I won't exercise, so I guess I'll just give up and get fat." Many people have lost or stabilized their weight just by eating the proper foods. Following are two examples of studies that will get you to thinking about prevention. A cover story in Newsweek of September 4, 2000, by Jerry Adler and Claudia Kalb, did a good job of summarizing recent statistics concerning diabetes. 85% of all diabetes sufferers are overweight or obese. A study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that diagnosed cases of diabetes increased by a third between 1990 and 1998. The most alarming statistic in the CDC study was that the incidence of diabetes increased 40% over the 8 years, and for people in their 30s, it went up nearly 70%. Further, in 1991, only 7 states had obesity rates over 15%, while by 1998, 45 states had rates of obesity above 15%. States with diabetes rates over 6% jumped from 9 states to 22 states from 1991 to 1998. A study of more than 1 million people, sponsored by the American Cancer Society, found that simply being overweight can cause a higher incidence of cancer and heart disease and can cut your life short. It, the study, settles once and for all any lingering questions about whether weight alone increases the risk of death and disease, said Dr. Joanne Manson, a Harvard University endocrinologist and preventative health specialist. The Newsweek article and the American Cancer Society study did a real service by further alerting people to the epidemic of obesity and diabetes and the problems they cause. We agree that obesity and the incidence of diabetes are closely related. The primary goal of Sugar Busters is to help people of all ages not to get overweight or obese in the first place. For those who have already contracted diabetes or are obese and at high risk, the Sugar Busters lifestyle of consuming low-glycemic, high-fiber carbohydrates is the best preventative program we can recommend. Let's examine some of the types of problems that we believe frequently can be avoided by simply changing the way you eat. Diabetes. Diabetes is much more prevalent in overweight or obese people. The Harvard Nurses Health Study found that people who ate low glycemic index, high-fiber carbohydrates, like those recommended in Sugar Busters, had a 250% less risk of contracting diabetes. To ignore the results of this huge long-term study, you really are playing with fire. To prevent type 2 diabetes, follow the Sugar Busters eating plan. Lose enough of your body weight to get your body mass index below 25. Eat fewer trans fats and saturated fats. Stop smoking. Eat more whole grains and fiber, and exercise several days a week. A recent study using data from the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study that began in 1986 concluded that in men, a diet high in whole grains is associated with a lower risk of type 2 diabetes. Efforts should be made to replace refined grain with whole grain foods. You will move from a high-risk group to a low-risk group and hopefully never develop type 2 diabetes. Listen to Chapter 13 for further discussion. Cardiovascular disease. Dr. Gerald Berenson, who has led the world-renowned Bogalusa Heart Study for over 30 years, found that the earliest reliable indicator of future cardiovascular disease was observing an increase in blood serum levels of insulin. A low-glycemic diet, like that recommended in Sugar Busters, never causes much of a rise in insulin levels in the first place. Hypoglycemia, low blood sugar. The authors have been contacted over and over by people who have cured their problem with low blood sugar by switching to the Sugar Busters lifestyle. Listen to Chapter 14 for further discussion. Stroke. The bioflavonoids and some other natural antioxidants found in many low and moderate glycemic carbohydrates help make the platelets in the blood less adhesive and less prone to clotting, which is the major cause of stroke. Kidney disease. Diabetics have a much higher incidence of renal kidney disease than non-diabetics. Poor circulation. Again, this is a problem much more common in people with diabetes, and it can lead to amputation. Depression. Blood sugar swings can certainly aggravate, if not cause, depression in some people. Refer to Sugar Blues by Michael Duffy. Elevated triglycerides and cholesterol. Many Sugar Busters followers have experienced a drop in both triglyceride and cholesterol levels once they started eating a low-glycemic regimen that lowered their daily need for as much insulin. The following is an example of what a good diet can achieve for someone with a serious blood sugar and cholesterol problem. Jerry Jordan, from Columbus, Ohio, is immediate past chairman of the National Independent Producers Association of America, and this is his story. Jerry told one of our authors in 1999 that he was having an extended problem with his triglycerides, which were extremely high, 1,410, and that he had become allergic to the various medications, including Lipitor, that were being administered by his doctor. His cholesterol was also high, 240. He was somewhat overweight, and he was beginning to wonder just how long he would live. After being given a copy of Sugar Busters, Cut Sugar to Trim Fat, by one of our authors, Jerry decided to change his way of eating and found that, without medication, he could reduce his blood fats and cholesterol dramatically. Within a few months, Jerry's triglyceride levels had dropped from 1,410 to 320. His cholesterol was down from 240 to 186. And although weight loss was not his original goal, he did lose 28 pounds. 3 years later, except for occasional temporary rises, Jerry's triglycerides are still averaging only 250. His cholesterol is still in the 180s, and he has successfully retained his weight loss. He credits the Sugar Busters lifestyle with causing a dramatic turnaround in his blood chemistries. Just think of all the complications that probably have been prevented by Jerry simply eating in a way that dramatically lowered his blood fats and cholesterol. Osteoporosis. A recent study by researchers at Creighton University of 96 women, age 65 and older, found that those who drank more than 3 cups of coffee containing caffeine had more osteoporotic problems than the women who drank 3 cups or less. In a 3-year period, those who drank over 3 cups per day lost significantly more spinal bone and, in fact, more bone throughout their body. Cancer. Being overweight not only increases the risk of cancer, but decreases the chance of survival after getting cancer. All of the preceding health problems can, and usually do, cause a greatly diminished quality of life or even premature death. If preventing them were very painful, like sticking a long needle in the stomach every day, one might say, well, the heck with prevention. But switching to the Sugar Busters lifestyle and having to avoid only a handful of foods clearly is not painful. So get on with the prevention. Chapter 6. The Epidemic of Childhood Obesity and What to Do About It. Listen up, mothers, fathers, grandparents, and friends. The U.S. Surgeon General in 1998 declared childhood obesity a national epidemic. Your young ones are getting fat and sick. Obesity in children has doubled in the last decade. Statistically, fat children become fat adults. 60% of fat children have health problems directly related to being fat. The more a child or adult is overweight, the greater the occurrence of related health problems. Even those overweight or obese children who appear to be healthy today are laying the groundwork for an adulthood that is likely to have a greatly diminished quality of life. Type 2 diabetes, which used to be seen almost exclusively in adults, and which was also called adult-onset diabetes for just that reason, has tripled in children in the last decade. Diabetes is a devastating disease for children as well as adults. While genetics plays a part in one's susceptibility to contracting diabetes, genetics alone cannot account for this sudden surge in the incidence of type 2 diabetes in our children. On the other hand, the increase in childhood diabetes is following the sudden surge in childhood obesity. Refer to Chapter 13 for a discussion of the problems diabetes causes in adults. The following other diseases or problems are more common in overweight and obese children: heart attacks, high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, elevated triglycerides, asthma, orthopedic problems, sleep apnea, eating disorders, low self-esteem, depression, suicide. Also, pathology reports show that 25% of 19-year-olds nationwide show early symptoms of hardening of the arteries, arteriosclerosis. Poor diet and elevated insulin levels are thought by many to be the prime contributors to these shocking statistics. While you may think we are trying to scare you to death with these numbers, we are merely reporting the facts. We think you might understand why we have recently written a book on children's problems with obesity, Sugar Busters for Kids. The new book contains specific meal plans for children, new research information, charts, and formulas to determine your child's body mass index, BMI, and illustrated rhymes to help your child learn the principles of good eating habits, and it emphasizes the harm done by the terrible trio of sodas, French fries, and candy. What can you do about your children's eating habits? At a very early age, you can do almost everything. But as they grow older, you will have less and less influence. However, less does not mean none. The main thing to do is to be a role model for them. Tell them what to do and then do it yourself. Beyond that, keep the wrong things out of your kitchen and pantry. The things that are bad for them are the same things we say to avoid in this book. For a real short list of foods to avoid, follow this advice. Eliminate sugar-sweetened soft drinks, French fries, white potatoes, white rice, white bread, corn, candy, and added sugars. Despite what the purists commonly claim, government studies continue to find no significant problems for humans from consumption of either aspartame or saccharin-based sweeteners. If you prefer natural sweeteners, use stevia or fructose. We have covered the dietary consequences of a poor diet relative to obese and fat children. Exercise also plays a key role. Children simply are not getting enough exercise at home or at school. You can and should try to change that at home and at school. In 2001, the Surgeon General reported that only 25% of high school students participated in daily physical education. Some schools in America no longer even offer recess or organized physical activities. Set limits on TV viewing and other sedentary activities when they come home. In a study conducted at the University of Miami School of Medicine, researchers found that adolescents who exercised regularly have higher grades and better relationships with their parents than do their less active peers. The active children also have a lower incidence of depression and are less likely to use drugs. Children are easy targets for shrewd marketers. When you see them being urged to eat something unhealthy, point it out to them. This will eventually teach them to be wary of media advertising and help them to be more discerning throughout life. Dr. Marion Nestle, chairman of the Department of Nutrition at New York University and author of Food Politics, points out that only 20% of the food dollar goes to the farmer, while 80% goes to advertising. Most of all, be a good role model for your children and their friends. Your sphere of influence might be wider than you think. Stress healthy eating instead of dieting, particularly crash dieting. Remember that the Sugar Busters eating plan will satisfy their appetite. A study of low-glycemic diets versus a reduced-fat diet with an equal amount of calories on 107 obese but otherwise healthy children by Dr. David S. Ludwig, director of the obesity program at Children's Hospital in Boston, found that body mass index, BMI, decreased more in the low-glycemic diet, like that recommended in Sugar Busters. Lest your vigilance wane on serving your children some of the forbidden foods, bolster your resolve by recalling the list of the medical problems caused by childhood obesity. And remember that those same problems associated with obesity also apply to you and your spouse. If you help them remain slim and healthy, you will spare them the emotional trauma of being ostracized or treated cruelly, as are so many children who become obese. We all want our children to live long and healthy lives. Analysis of 3,457 participants in the Framingham study reported in Annals of Internal Medicine indicate that overweight 40-year-old males and females lost 7 years off their life expectancy, and obese females lost 5.8 years. And remember, nearly 80% of fat children become fat adults. Chapter 7. Digestion and Metabolism. The digestion and metabolism of the foods we eat are the keys to success in maintaining good nutrition and normal body weight. Because we are what we eat, this is an important chapter for the proper understanding of our diet concept. It will provide you with a basic understanding of these processes so that you can maximize your gains in achieving these goals. This book is being written for a broad, pun intended, audience, including healthcare professionals, so we will use some technical terms from time to time. Digestion. Digestion encompasses the entire process from the time food is eaten until it is finally absorbed by the intestinal cells and sent on its way to the liver for metabolism. The most important aspect of digestion is the breakdown of proteins, fats, and carbohydrates into successively smaller units that can then be absorbed into the bloodstream and lymphatics to be used by the body in different ways. Before any of this can happen, an integral part of the digestive process is the mixing and churning, much like a concrete mixer, that occurs in the stomach. This process allows foods to be softened and mixed with fluid and be subjected to the initial phases of digestion. This mixing finally culminates in the gradual emptying of material from the stomach into the small intestine. Liquids empty from the stomach fairly quickly, within minutes, but solids empty much more slowly. The time that it takes for half of the stomach's solid contents to empty is somewhere between 30 and 60 minutes. Smaller solid particles empty before larger ones in a very orderly sequential fashion. The last solids to empty are fiber or indigestible solids, such as those found in leafy vegetables. When your mother advised, chew your food well, she was instinctively telling you the right thing to do, because the smaller the particles, the more quickly the food would clear your stomach and perhaps avoid that uncomfortable feeling of fullness or the onset of indigestion. On the other hand, the more slowly the stomach empties and food is absorbed in the small intestine, the more slowly the blood sugar rises and the insulin peaks. Stomach emptying can be delayed by many external factors, including the types of foods eaten. A meal containing a large amount of fat can significantly delay stomach emptying, as can the drinking of large amounts of alcohol prior to or with the meal. While this may lower somewhat the glycemic result, slow or delayed stomach emptying can lead to the reflux of stomach contents, by this time usually very acidic, into the lower esophagus, causing heartburn, chest discomfort, fullness, and even nausea and vomiting. Many of us can recall these problems after a late evening of dining and drinking and going to bed with a full stomach. The moral is not to overconsume the fats, alcohols, or fruits in the first place. As this stomach mix is gradually emptied into the small intestine, the breakdown of foods for absorption by our bodies begins in earnest. In the first part of the small intestine, called the duodenum, bile from the gallbladder and enzymes from the pancreas mix with the stomach contents and speed the breakdown of the different foods into smaller and smaller units. This mix moves farther down the small intestine, where absorption takes place by the cells lining the intestine. It is important to point out that the mixing of certain foods can have tremendous implications later on as these smaller units become absorbed. For instance, eating foods containing a modest amount of insoluble fiber can affect the rate of digestion and absorption of carbohydrates, thus causing these carbohydrates to have a much lower insulin-stimulating effect than if eaten by themselves. This would obviously be a good thing for the body. Fruits eaten by themselves also are digested and absorbed at better rates than if eaten together with other carbohydrates and fats. The negative effect that eating fruits at the wrong time can have on the other foods in the digestive process is covered in Chapter 10. Metabolism. To metabolize essentially means to change, and it entails the many processes that transform the nutrients in food to chemical substances that can be used by our bodies. The entire process is obviously quite complex. Metabolic rates often vary from person to person. This means that weight gain or loss for two people on the identical diet can vary considerably. Although the process is complex, you should know that the liver plays the central role in the metabolism of foods, including alcohol, and in the metabolism of the majority of medications. So it is easy to see the importance of the liver in our nutritional well-being, and it behooves us all to take very good care of it, because medical science cannot yet duplicate its functions. When the liver goes, it is adios, amigo. Now let's talk about what types of food get metabolized for use by our bodies. Everything we eat is either carbohydrates, which are broken down to simple sugar, 80% glucose, and the rest fructose or galactose, depending on whether we have had fruit or dairy products, proteins, which are broken down to amino acids, fats, which are broken down to triglycerides, and fiber, which is cellulose and cannot be broken down further. Of these four substances, only three are absorbed from our digestive tracts: sugars, amino acids, and triglycerides. Carbohydrates. Carbohydrates can be found in both plant and animal food sources. The overwhelming majority of the carbohydrates we eat are in the form of sugars and starches. Carbohydrates can be classified as simple sugars or more complex sugars, such as starch. All carbohydrates absorbed by the body are eventually converted to glucose. Glucose is the body's main fuel, much like the gasoline that is put in a car. Glucose is either used immediately to provide energy or stored in the form of glycogen in the liver and in muscle to be utilized later. Any remaining glucose then is stored as fat. In understanding the metabolism of carbohydrates and how this relates to our recommendations for good nutrition and weight loss, it is very important to think of carbohydrates in terms of how much of a peak or rise of glucose they can cause within the body when eaten. This can be more simply called the glycemic potential, which varies for different types of carbohydrates, and in more scientific terms can be defined as the glycemic index. The glycemic index graph in Figure 7 on your PDF companion simply reflects the area under the curve representing the rise in blood sugar over a given time. Glucose has been assigned a relative value of 100 as its glycemic index, and the values of other carbohydrates are simply related to this level. Some substances actually have a higher glycemic potential than glucose. You will hear more on the importance of a carbohydrate's glycemic potential later. When the blood glucose level drops lower than it should be, glycogen, which is glucose in its stored form in the body, is broken down into glucose to raise the level of glucose and maintain a normal blood sugar level. Carbohydrates, such as starches, which have a more complex structure, can, contrary to some commonly held beliefs, be digested and absorbed nearly as fast as the more simple carbohydrates, such as table sugar. When a carbohydrate is eaten, there is a rise in the level of blood glucose commensurate with the type and amount of carbohydrate ingested, i.e., higher for sugar, lower for fresh fruit. This rise in blood sugar, glucose, is then followed by the release of insulin, which causes a fall in the level of glucose primarily as it is driven into the cells of the body where it can be utilized as instant fuel or stored mainly as fat. Following this, the glucose level returns to its normal baseline. Proteins. Proteins, the sources of which are meats, nuts, dairy products, and some vegetables, are made of subunits called amino acids. These amino acids are released from the protein by the action of enzymes secreted by the pancreas. Without these enzymes, protein molecules would not be absorbed because they are too large and complex to enter the bloodstream. Fortunately, in cases where pancreatic enzymes are missing, they can be provided in capsule form that can be taken with meals to aid the digestive process. An average adult should consume per day at least 1 gram of protein for each kilogram, 2.2 pounds, of weight, or somewhere between 55 and 70 grams, 2 to 2.5 ounces, for the average man or woman. Because there are both animal and vegetable sources of proteins, and neither of these sources provides all of the amino acids that the body needs, a diet should be well-balanced to provide both sources of protein. Once proteins have been broken down into amino acids, they can be absorbed from the intestine and metabolized by the liver. Then, in general, amino acids can either be used by the body as the basic building blocks of all proteins, which make up all cells, hormones, and neurotransmitters, substances that relay signals in the nervous system, or amino acids can be converted into glucose or sugar by the liver through a process called gluconeogenesis, which is the manufacture of glucose from non-carbohydrate food sources such as protein. The body's ability to manufacture its own glucose is important for maintaining normal energy requirements during periods of low carbohydrate consumption, as glucose is the main fuel the body uses to meet its energy requirements. Fats. Fats, or lipids, are complex molecules composed of fatty acids and are derived from both animal and vegetable origins. Fats must be digested through the actions of pancreatic enzymes called lipases. Otherwise, they cannot enter the body to any great extent and are passed in the stool. Even after fats are broken down into subunits, most of these remain insoluble in water and require a special type of absorption. Bile from the liver, which is stored in the gallbladder, plays a very important role in this absorption of fats by emulsifying or dissolving them. This is akin to using soap or any detergent to help in dissolving an oily substance. Without this process, fat subunits would be too large to enter the bloodstream from the intestine. Some individuals who lack pancreatic enzymes must take enzymes with their food. Fats are absorbed through the intestinal tract as glycerols and are reconstituted while still in the intestinal wall as triglycerides that then enter the lymphatic system, where these fats can be used by all the body's cells. Cells use fat as fuel for energy production, as an important component of cell structures, and as a source of many essential substances manufactured by cells. An important function of fat that no one likes to think of is to provide insulation in the form of a layer of fat immediately underneath the skin. This should be only a thin layer, however, and it is almost always a source of constant restructuring in modern man and woman's attempts to control weight and body shape. Cholesterol is not what most people think. Contrary to common belief, cholesterol is not a fat and has nothing to do with saturated fats. It is a compound belonging to a family of substances called sterols. Cholesterol can combine with fat as it circulates in the bloodstream to be distributed to all cells. Cholesterol is a vital substance in the formation of steroids, bile acids, hormones, and other substances. Because cholesterol is so important, the body must provide a constant supply of cholesterol to the cells. Therefore, the body not only takes in cholesterol from food, but also manufactures it, primarily in the liver. The liver can provide enough cholesterol to meet the body's needs, even if a person were to take in no cholesterol in food. Cholesterol manufactured in the liver circulates as lipoproteins for delivery to the cells. It is during this circulation in the bloodstream that cholesterol can be deposited on major arterial walls, especially at points of irritation, roughness, or small breaks in the lining of these vessels. This is the process referred to as arteriosclerosis, and it is the underlying process leading to coronary heart disease and, in some cases, hypertension, high blood pressure. Now you know how your digestive system works and some of the things that help or hinder its efficiency. We keep mentioning and hinting at the importance of insulin. The next chapter is dedicated to helping you better understand the insulin connection. Chapter 8. Insulin. You may ask, why do I want to know more about insulin? It is just another seven-letter hormone. Insulin is the maestro, the conductor, the chief. It is the mission control system for metabolism. We must understand the actions of insulin to understand why the diet works. Ready for some additional technical but hopefully interesting information? Banting and Best discovered insulin in 1921. This hormone is manufactured and secreted by the beta cells of the pancreas. The human pancreas stores about 200 units of insulin. Normal people secrete about 25 to 30 units of insulin daily. Insulin is like a broom. It sweeps glucose, amino acids, and free fatty acids into cells, where potential energy is stored as fat and glycogen to be used later. In normal individuals, blood sugar levels do not vary much because of the harmonious and compensating hormonal actions of insulin and glucagon. Insulin is the only hormone that can prevent sugar, glucose, from rising to dangerously high levels. Glucagon, also secreted by the pancreas, prevents the blood sugar from falling too low, to hypoglycemic levels. Whereas insulin has been referred to as the hormone of feasting, glucagon is the hormone of fasting or starvation. The main role of glucagon in humans appears to be the prevention of hypoglycemia, low blood glucose or blood sugar, by causing the normal breakdown of glycogen in the liver to form glucose. It also causes gluconeogenesis, which is the